This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. If I told you tobacco causes more than 440,000 premature deaths every year in this country, you might be surprised. But if I showed you a photograph of a throat cancer survivor with a permanent stoma, you might be saddened or even angered. Michael Schwalbe hopes to capture the emotion behind the statistics in his new book, Smoke Damage, Voices from the Front Lines of America's Tobacco Wars. At first glance, it looks like a coffee table book. It has 46 beautiful black and white portraits with very little prose, but the photographs tell a more troubling story than your average book of pictures. Schwalbe is a sociologist at North Carolina State University. He's with me in the studio today to talk about his book and tobacco's deadly public health legacy. Michael Schwalbe, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
This book is, you're a sociologist, it takes a look at the social causes and consequences of tobacco use, but the project is very personal to you. What's the legacy of tobacco in your own family?
The main legacy is that my father died of lung cancer from smoking cigarettes. I also have 9 other family members who suffered from tobacco-related disease, and that may sound extraordinary, but actually it's not. There are several other people in the book who could mount a similar tally.
Why did you choose to tell the story through personal stories?
Well, the statistics are widely available. They're overwhelming. In fact, I think they're numbing. When you talk about 443,000 tobacco-related deaths in the U.S. every year, it's hard to get an emotional grasp of a figure like that. So what I wanted to do was to tell the personal stories and to lend appropriate emotional weight to those statistics and to really bring them home in a more powerful way.
Why black and white photographs?
Well, black and white extracts from real life, and it presents real life in a stark form without distractions. And I wanted the photographs in the book to be representative. They're partly about the individuals, of course, but they're also partly about a larger phenomenon that involves so many more millions of people. So black and white is kind of an abstracting medium that conveys that message.
How did you cast for this book?
Well, I casted a wide net to find people to appear in the book. Some of them were well-known from their own public work as tobacco control advocates. Other people I found through newspaper stories, networks. One person would recommend another. Other people were written about in media, and I would track them down and ask if they'd want to be in the book. So all different means of finding people to be in the book.
And you have people who are survivors of emphysema, lung disease, that sort of thing, but you also include, as you suggest, researchers, litigators, and farmers. Why?
Well, I started with the idea of documenting the experiences of tobacco widows, people like my mother who cared for and then lost a loved one. And as I thought more about the nature of the problem, I realized there are a great many more people, a great many more categories of people who are affected by tobacco-related disease. So I started looking to include the legislators, litigators, caregivers, as you said, the researchers, tobacco control activists and educators, people who are affected in many different ways by tobacco-related disease.
And how did you decide on who to include in the book? A lot of people fit the bill.
A lot of people fit the bill. I was looking for interesting stories. I was looking for people who could represent a dimension of the experience that would resonate with other people. So I could have, you know, obviously you could do hundreds of books like this and still never tap the full range of experience. But what I was trying to do is to find people who could bring different dimensions of the problem to light.
On the show today, we're talking with Michael Schwalbe, who is a professor of sociology at North Carolina State University. He has written a book called, and composed a book, I should say, called Smoke Damage, Voices from the Front Lines of America's Tobacco Wars. We're going to take your phone calls today as well. You want to hear about your struggles with the tobacco industry or tobacco, or perhaps you have another point of view and want to give us a call at 877-962-9862 to join our conversation today. You can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Now, nobody from the tobacco industry is in this book. Why not?
Well, actually, you could say there are a couple of people who were formerly connected to the tobacco industry. There are 2 former tobacco farmers in the book. They were connected to the industry for generations. Jeffrey Wigand, who was the subject of the film The Insider, was connected to the industry. He's in the book. And I think other people who are connected to the industry probably would have had some stock stories to tell. And they have their platforms, and they have billions of dollars to promote their message. I didn't need to lend my support to that.
Weigand, of course, the famous whistleblower.
Right.
Who, as you say, there was a documentary film that focused on his activities. What kind of patterns did you discover? We should talk a little bit about the format of the book, too. Mm-hmm. It's a photograph and then a brief profile of the individual.
The book as a whole consists of an introductory essay, a concluding essay, but the core of it consists of the black and white photographs along with a descriptive paragraph about each person and about 500 words excerpted from an interview. And in some cases, the interviews were brief, perhaps 40 minutes. And you mentioned Jeffrey Weigand. I talked to him for about 4.5 hours.
Did you find people, as you said, you cast a wide net. Certainly a lot of people are eligible to be in this book. Were there those who turned you down and why?
There were a few. And I think on the part of the professional tobacco control people, it was just a matter of them being busy and hard to track down. I was teaching full time during the course of doing the book, so my options for travel were a little bit limited. But most people cared deeply about the issue one way or another, and I think were flattered to be invited to be in the book. And there were more people I wish I could have included. But the cooperation was terrific in the course of doing the project.
In doing your interviews, did patterns emerge? What did you draw from all of those interviews?
Well, there were some patterns having to do with, for instance, tobacco-related disease. I wasn't looking specifically for patterns, but they did emerge. One that I noted was a tendency on the part of many people to be misdiagnosed or late diagnosed, people who were suffering from some tobacco-related disease. Problems associated or that were eventually linked to tobacco use were at first attributed to laryngitis, allergies, and later these turned out to be cancer. So that was a clear pattern. Another pattern, which is widely known, is that most people start smoking when they're teenagers and then struggle greatly over the course of many years to try to quit. But that wasn't a pattern that I discovered in any sense. It was just one that emerged. And I think one other pattern is that a number of people commented on how the wide availability of tobacco products in our society led them to think that the product was not as dangerous as it is. And that came up again and again in interviews on the part of people who are my age, maybe born in the 1950s. People who had been born earlier perhaps didn't have as much information, but certainly people of my generation had that information. So I was wondering why they would start smoking and keep smoking. And many of them said they'd the fact that you can buy cigarettes in grocery stores, gas stations, convenience stores, drug stores, where you get your medicine, led them to think that maybe it wasn't as harmful as some people said.
And were there differences from one generation to another in terms of how much information people had? And then, as you say, sort of what you do with it as you get a little bit, as the decades roll on, more information about both the addictive qualities and the danger of smoking became known.
Sure. People of my parents' generation, born in the 1930s, many of them started smoking in late 1940s, early 1950s. And the information, while it was known to the scientific community and, interestingly, known to the tobacco industry, was not widely publicized. It wasn't until 1964 in the major Surgeon General's report of that year that the research that had been done up to that point was summarized and widely publicized. But, of course, at that point, people who were addicted to nicotine had reasons to discount that information. And, of course, the tobacco industry for many years tried to sow doubt about the health effects of smoking.
Now, these days, it's pretty clear. We know that nicotine is addictive. We know that cigarette smoke kills, even secondary smoke kills, and it leads to, as we say, close to 500,000 premature deaths every year. And the smoking rates have really been drastically reduced over time since those messages have come out and been repeated. Is there a need for this book now?
Well, I think there's a need for it. The issue is, I mean, if you're talking about 443,000 people dying every year, that suggests a pretty strong need. And there's certainly room to do a lot more in terms of policy and education to continue to bring smoking rates down. They've leveled off now. We've got an adult rate of around 21% in the U.S. That's still 46 million people. And that rate has leveled off at around 20% for high school or graduating high school seniors. So we've got another generation that's smoking, not at the same high rates as in the 1960s, But still, that's a lot of people.
Though if you think about it, given the amount of information that is available now and all of the programs and campaigns that have been funded to discourage smoking, if there are still 46 million people smoking, is there anything that will convince them not to?
Well, I don't know that it's all about convincing them not to, especially when you're talking about an addiction that takes root in adolescence. It's not a rational decision. In fact, I even make fun of it in the book. I say that it's not as if adults, mature adults, are looking for a stress reduction technique and they consider, yoga and meditation and exercise and smoking as an alternative. That's not how it happens. We're talking about an addiction that takes root in adolescence. So it really needs to be interrupted at that point.
On the State of Things today, my guest Michael Schwalbe, professor of sociology at NC State, author of the new book Smoke Damage. Just ahead, we'll meet some of the people whose stories are told in Michael's book and hear how their lives have been affected by tobacco use, and your phone calls at 877-962-9862. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about the social cost of tobacco. Michael Schwalbe is my guest. His new book is called Smoke Damage, Voices from the Front Lines of America's Tobacco Wars. It includes testimony from 46 men and women who are both heroes and victims in the struggle with worldwide tobacco epidemic. We've got some of those voices joining us now. Sally Herndon is with me in the studio. She's the head of the Tobacco Prevention and Control Branch in the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome back to the program, Sally. Good to have
you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us, Wade Hampton, joining us by phone from Albemarle, North Carolina. He's an ex-smoker with a laryngectomy. He is a survivor. Wade, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Cliff Douglas is on the phone. He is in a studio in Michigan where he is director of the University of Michigan Tobacco Research Network. Welcome, Cliff.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate the invitation.
877-962-9862 is the number you can call if you want to join this conversation, or you can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Cliff, you've been a consultant in many of the big tobacco liability lawsuits in the last couple of decades. A lot of litigators like you have made big progress in the war on tobacco. Why are we still talking about this?
We're talking about it for the very reasons that Michael describes so clearly, so well. The problem is not behind us, as it's described in his wonderful book. And I do want to take a moment to congratulate him on its publication. I know it took a lot of work, and it's a real breakthrough, I think, in helping educate and explain this to people on a very personal level. So the fact that we still have one out of five deaths in the United States caused by cigarette smoking and rising rates of smoking and other tobacco use around the world with related increases in illness and death tells us why we have to keep working on this as hard as we can, using all of the tools at our disposal, only one of which is in the legal arena.
Sally, what has been tobacco's public health legacy here in North Carolina?
Well, we've made great strides in North Carolina over the last few years in three ways: in teen tobacco prevention, in reducing exposure to secondhand smoke, and in helping tobacco users who want to quit. Cigarette smoking among our middle schoolers and high schools are at an all-time low. We're very proud of this progress. Thanks to the investment of MSA dollars through the Health and Wellness Trust Fund, we have cigarette smoking declining from 15% in middle school to 4%, and from 32% in high school in 1999 to 17% in 2009. So this is huge progress. One of the reasons for this is because there was an investment of people like Wade Hampton, who you're going to hear from in a moment, and others who have suffered real serious health consequences, real people suffering really serious health consequences from tobacco use, telling their story and telling it in a way that local community grantees can pick up on it and have these conversations back at home. And that's been a very effective part of the teen tobacco prevention program. It's called the TRUE campaign, Tobacco Reality Unfiltered. North Carolina has also made great strides recently in eliminating exposure to secondhand smoke. Our schools are 100% tobacco-free, building and grounds, our hospitals, even our prisons are smoke-free. We no longer allow smoking in government buildings in North Carolina, and in many workplaces, including restaurants and bars, our most recent success. In fact, we've reduced exposure secondhand smoke in the workplace from 14% down to 8% of workers who are regularly exposed.
Well, Wade Hampton, I want to ask you, you're one of the survivors featured in Michael's book, Smoke Damage. How did you meet Michael, and why did you agree to be in it?
Well, for several years, I've worked with tobacco education among the young folks, and Michael contacted me through our group called SAVE, which was funded by the Health and Wellness Trust Fund. That is Survivors and Victims of Tobacco Empowerment. And we travel in North Carolina trying to educate middle and high school kids about the dangers of tobacco. And so consequently, Michael contacted me through that, and I was able to meet with him, and we had our interview.
And you decided to be in this book and photographed for it. Why?
I'm not very pretty, but I would like people to know that I've got a hole in my neck, and it was because I got addicted to tobacco.
When? How did you start smoking?
Well, my dad smoked. My uncle raised tobacco. I was around it all my life. And in my era growing up, it was cool to smoke. It was important when you're a man almost to become a smoker. I didn't think there was anything wrong.
I want to go to the phones right now. Rob is on the line. Hello, Rob.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
My question, I'm not a tobacco user. I have a sister-in-law who uses tobacco. We try to prevent her or tell her not to use it. She has a master's. She seems pretty smart, but it's just so difficult to do it. But my question is, with all these organizations that are intended to inform, truth.org and whatnot, is the outcome to eventually outlaw or prohibit its use? Because we know through alcohol prohibition that, you know, prohibition doesn't work. It seems like, you know, it's pretty unconstitutional to tell somebody they can't do something to their body if they want to use it. So that's
right.
My question.
All right. Well, thanks, Rob. I don't know who wants to take that. I'll start with you, Sally. What are the goals here?
Okay. In North Carolina, we're really working to put in place evidence-based things, things that we know work, things like the True campaign, things like eliminating smoking in our public places and work sites and restaurants and bars. But we also have a really great resource. It's the Quitline, Quitline NC, which is free and available for everybody. It's 1-800-QUIT-NOW or 1-800-784-8669. And this isn't a group of people who puts the guilt on you. This is a group of people who know how to help people quit. It's very difficult to quit. But if you use a combination of the kind of coaching you get with a Quitline with the new medications that are approved by FDA, and there are many more of these now, you're three times more likely to quit successfully than if you just try to go cold turkey or go it alone.
Cliff, what about that? What about the notion of prohibition? You heard Michael say one of the conflicting messages that he heard most frequently from people, or the fact was of this conflicting message. Look, you sell them in drugstores. How dangerous can they be? Will prohibition work, and should that be a goal?
Michael makes the excellent point in his book that the only reason cigarettes are legal today is by virtue of historic accident. When they were introduced into the marketplace over a century ago, little to nothing was understood about the health impact and the kind of epidemic, the calamity that was going to take place. But by the time that was starting to be understood, really in the early 1950s, and that was even before the first Surgeon General's report in the 1960s, we already had tens of millions of addicted smokers. The major manufacturers had ensured that free cigarettes would be included in soldiers' rations during World War II and so forth. Prohibition is not on the table, so that should be clear. The objective now is really with an eye toward political, social, cultural reality in this country. We do have 45 or 46 million Americans who smoke, the vast majority of whom are addicted to the product. So keeping that in mind, the objective is to use our cessation tools, our policy tools, our education tools to help veteran smokers to quit and to ensure that young people don't start. So those are really the objectives and ones that I think have borne a lot of fruit. In fact, the paradox here, if I can just add this point, is that the battle to against the cigarette epidemic is the single most successful public health victory in American history. The flip side of the coin, however, is that the problem was and is so serious that even with that, it remains the single largest cause of preventable death in America.
Michael, how do you feel about that, what the goal should be, and the fact that there has been so much success? Does that encourage us to continue on the same path, or do we have to take a look at other remedies if we want to get down below 20%?
Oh, we can get down below 20%. I think it's important to get that rate down as low as possible. How low that rate would ultimately be in a free society, it's hard to say, 5% maybe. We know what kind of policies work, and we know what policies have been effective, as both Sally and Cliff mentioned. Education is important, but that's not just health education. I think it's important to educate people, young people, about the manipulation that the industry attempts in trying to sell them this product. Smoke-free air laws that make smoking inconvenient and protect health at the same time are important. Comprehensive advertising bans are important. The industry is adept at evading partial marketing bans, but comprehensive advertising bans are effective. Higher taxes and support for cessation programs, as Sally mentioned. All of those policies work. We need to use them more aggressively and get the rate down as low as possible. But we're not talking about prohibition, I think, for reasons that the caller acknowledges would be difficult.
Wade Hampton, I want to get back to you and get a little bit more of your story. You're talking through a voice box. Tell us how your life was changed because of your cancer and through smoking.
Well, eventually I wound up on disability. I wound up retiring. I breathe through a hole in my neck. Air does not pass through my nose. In other words, I can't smell good food or bad smells, either one. I have very little stamina. I cannot swim. I had 6 weeks of radiation. So my, and that was after my surgery. So I have a compromised ability to swallow. It just basically changed everything, except my attitude towards preventing the next generation from starting to smoke.
I wonder if, you said when you were growing up, the full health consequences of smoking weren't known. Now, it turns out that we've learned the tobacco industry was well aware of this and not disclosing, and in some cases being deceptive about what they knew. When you found all of that out, what was your reaction?
Well, now you have to live with their decisions. I find it, I would find it hard to go to work if you figured every day you were killing your customers. But, you know, that's their business. I have my position, and I just don't want to see another generation of people addicted. And anybody that is on tobacco, I hope they can find a way to get out off through the resources that are available.
Cliff Douglas, you had taken a number of those cases to court. Give us some of the details about what was known and what was concealed throughout the process.
Michael has a wonderful, if you can call it that, quote in his book, taken from the court decision in the U.S. Justice Department's racketeering lawsuit against the major cigarette companies. And Judge Gladys Kessler there, this is a case whose decision was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. Let me just read very briefly from her decision because it directly responds to the question, I think, Frank. She wrote, over the course of more than 50 years, defendants lied, misrepresented, and deceived the American public, including smokers and the young people they avidly sought as, quote unquote, replacement smokers. In other words, replacing those who had died or quit. About the devastating health effects of smoking and environmental tobacco smoke, they suppressed research, they destroyed documents, they manipulated the use of nicotine so as to increase and perpetuate addiction. and they distorted the truth about low-tar and light cigarettes so as to discourage smokers from quitting. And she goes on. That's just a snippet. But that really encapsulates what these cases focus on. And while the tobacco companies and their lawyers are extraordinarily powerful, their resources far outstrip anyone of us. The reason that some of these cases against the tobacco companies succeed is because of these facts, because of the fraud and deception and conspiracy that has now been proven with a whole lot of evidence.
That was illegal. Those cases have been disposed. What is legal is marketing, of course, and sales. That's going to continue. Give us an idea of what the tobacco industry is doing in terms of its marketing strategy these days.
Sure. Well, there are some restrictions that have been placed on tobacco marketing behavior. But again, I'm going to turn to Michael's book, where his introduction notes accurately that one of the more pernicious are the new marketing tactics devised in responding to the advertising restrictions. You know, it's like the squeezing of the balloon. You squeeze it at one end, and then it expands at another. And that kind of is an image I keep in mind when I think of the way the tobacco companies very effectively respond. So, for example, Light and Luscious Camel Number 9s, a new brand introduced in 2007, is stylishly packaged to appeal to teenage girls. And then there are many point-of-sale promotions, including price reductions, that are offered by the companies in convenience stores that are most likely to be patronized by teenagers. So those are just a couple of examples. There are a couple of examples that stem from the cigarette industry's expenditure of more than $12 billion with a B, more than $12 billion a year on their advertising and marketing activities. That's a lot of money to spend, and they know that they're doing it because it works.
Sally, to counter that now, we're going to see new packaging on for cigarettes that is going to be much more graphic in terms of illustrating the dangers of smoking. How effective do you think those packages will be?
Those packages have been on cigarettes in other parts of the developed world, and they are effective at getting people's attention. They won't stay stagnant. They'll rotate. And fortunately, our quit line number is going to be on every package of cigarettes. So not only will there be a clear, serious message about the health consequences of tobacco use, but there'll be help for tobacco users who want to quit.
If you talk about trying to addict teenagers, adolescents, people who, as Michael said, really aren't in a position to make a complete choice because of the other kinds of pressures they're facing, the fact that their minds aren't fully developed at that age, aren't some of these things attractive? Isn't that what young, the adolescent mind is looking for, rebellion and the sense that I will live forever, that will never be me? I mean, isn't it to some degree an attractive picture?
There is some of that with some of the teens, granted. But I think one of the things that's wonderful about this book is that it takes this problem out of the closet and allows smokers to really tell their stories, not as victims, but as survivors. In North Carolina growing up, I think people have not wanted to talk about this before, and this book gives people a new opportunity. I remember when we first started working with teenagers, and we had very bright kids working on this, and there had just been a recall of a particular tire that was causing blowouts and causing crashes. And he was a middle schooler, and he said quite clearly that, you know, if it was this bad for you, they'd recall it, wouldn't they? You know, and we do that with most other things in our society. So with that adolescent brain, I think it takes more work to really help them understand the serious health consequences, not just in a statistical way, like Michael says, but in real human consequences. And we thank Michael for this book, and we think that it'll really help us.
What kind of reaction have you gotten so far to the book, Michael? It's just out.
Well, the reaction from people in the book has been positive, which is encouraging to me because people trusted me with their images and with their stories, and I wanted to handle those images and stories in the most responsible and effective way I could. So getting positive feedback from people in the book and from people like Sally and Cliff, very important to me. That's been positive. I've gotten good responses from the media And it's important to me that people care about the issue and want me to talk about it, and I'm glad to do it wherever and whenever I can.
We will talk some more as our conversation continues on the state of things with sociologist Michael Schwalbe, author of Smoke Damage. Sally Herndon's here, head of the Tobacco Prevention and Control Branch of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Wade Hampton, a former smoker, laryngectomy survivor who speaks to school children about the dangers of tobacco use. Cliff Douglas, director of the University of Michigan Tobacco Research Network. Your phone calls as well, 877-962-9862. On the State of Things, please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour about tobacco's legacy in our state and around the globe, and why the tobacco epidemic persists despite decades of litigation and regulation. Michael Schwalbe has just published a book about the social cost of tobacco use. It's called Smoke Damage. He's with me in the studio, as is Sally Herndon, who heads North Carolina's Tobacco Prevention and Control Branch. Cliff Douglas is the director of the University of Michigan Tobacco Research Network and joins us from a studio in Ann Arbor. And Wade Hampton's on the phone from Albemarle, North Carolina, an anti-smoking advocate who targets middle school youth, talks to them about not smoking. We're taking your phone calls and emails as well, 877-962-9862, sot@wnc.org. Wade Hampton, we talked before the break about how these messages play with young people. You have graciously offered yourself as an example of the dangers of smoking. What happens when you go and talk to middle school students? How do they react?
It's one of the most pleasing experiences you can have. They normally listen very clearly because of a person with my voice. They realize the danger. They see the results of my 30 years of smoking. And I go in grocery stores, church, or wherever, and they come up and thank me for what I told them years before. So it's a message that they need to continue to get to realize that they're not being told the truth about everything, and it's not as pretty as it seems, and there are consequences that they may suffer, and they need to just look in their own families and see the people that have suffered due to tobacco use in their lifetime, and that usually leaves them kind of wide-eyed. And I think our middle schoolers are really sharp if you just tell them the truth and show them the results.
877-962-9862 if you want to join our conversation, as James in Boone has done. Hello, James.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm glad you mentioned the adolescent issue of rebellion, because I recently discovered that my son is a smoker. He's 20 now, and that came as a surprise to me. I didn't actually know he had been smoking, partly because he kept it from me because he knew I disapproved. But knowing his psychology, I know that was part of it. And I was just wondering if the panel is aware of Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, where he talks about social epidemics, and he talks about the threshold level of addiction for nicotine, and how and that risky behavior is common, experimental behavior is common in adolescents, and that by lowering the nicotine content of cigarettes, and I think it's like 7 milligrams of nicotine or something a day is a threshold addiction level, you could prevent... In other words, children could experiment with cigarettes, they could smoke a pack a day, and if the nicotine level was lower, they would never reach that addiction threshold in a pack of cigarettes. I'm wondering if the panel is aware of that or has read his book and
all right.
Get comments.
Well, let's get an answer. Thanks, James. Certainly the tobacco industry is well aware of those levels. They've been manipulating them for years and been studying their results. Cliff, what do we know about those levels?
It's a great question. I appreciate that. One of the most famous or infamous previously secret internal company documents emerged from Philip Morris. It was written back in about 1972 and authored by a PhD psychologist named William Dunn, whose self-assigned nickname was the Nicotine Kid. He wrote in that document that he shared with fellow scientists the following. He said, "Without nicotine, there would be no smoking." And the point here is that, in fact, there is doubtless a threshold for nicotine addiction. The challenge is really in the details of the science and figuring out where that lies, especially because there are individual differences and the like. But clearly, there's a number below which People simply won't get addicted, and kids who experiment won't end up becoming hooked. And one thing to keep in mind here on a practical political and regulatory level is that the Food and Drug Administration, which was for the first time granted authority to regulate tobacco products for health and safety just 2 years ago when President Obama signed it into law with great congressional support, they are assigned to review this very issue in the coming year or two to look at the science around potential nicotine reduction. And that is really a significant, significant issue in this fight, because if down the road, whenever that may be, we were to lower nicotine to less or even non-addictive levels, it could dramatically reshape this epidemic in this country.
And Sally, I know you've been part of the hearing process that has begun as a result of the FDA's oversight now. Tell us how that's going and where you think it might end up.
And the Food and Drug Administration is doing a very careful, deliberate job of understanding the complexity of this problem, including the public health aspects, including understanding the industry that it's now regulating. There have been a series of listening sessions that I've been fortunate to attend. And it's very interesting to try to understand this problem because it is very complex and there's not a single magic bullet that will help us solve this problem. FDA has begun its work in trying to reduce the problem by doing things like taking candy flavoring out of cigarettes that's attractive to kids, by taking words like light and low tar off of cigarettes that are deceptive to people and inducing people to think that they're using a product that's healthier than it is. It, as Cliff says, it will be a deliberative process. It will take some time because it is very complex. But I'm very optimistic about the opportunity to help reduce this problem through the FDA's regulation.
And you've been at this, in this position or doing this kind of work for about 20 years now. So you've seen the tobacco industry as an unregulated industry. It is now having to behave at these hearings as though it's because it's now a regulated industry. Does that change things? Does that change the tenor, the tone of these meetings at all?
Yes, I think it really does change things. We have had the opportunity in the past to work with tobacco farmers who at one stage really understood that they didn't want their kids to smoke. And we found some common ground with tobacco farmers in North Carolina and Virginia. We really want to help change this problem because nobody wants to go through what Wade has been through. You know, there are 11,000 people in North Carolina who die of this problem, and for every person who dies, 30 more are sick. Every time I go to a conference, I ask people who has had loved ones affected by this problem, and virtually everybody raises their hand. This is a very widespread problem, and I'm grateful for the progress that we're making now.
It is interesting, Michael, and I think we've talked about this in a different way, but the idea that public policy can make a difference in a very important public health issue. I mean, it's easy to despair over these figures or a policy, a question like this, particularly when you see 46 million people still smoking. And as you say, the numbers are very high, the death rate. But the fact is public policy can make a difference.
Policy has made a huge difference. It's been the lack of policy for many years that's led to this problem. And as we've come to understand both the scope of the problem and what needs to be done to minimize it, we've made some of the strides that Sally's talked about and Cliff's talked about. So, as I said, we need to keep working on all those angles.
So government is the solution, rest his soul. Let's go to the phones now. Maura is on the line from Chapel Hill.
Yes, hello. I am Native American, and our national smoking rates are around 40%. I'm not sure what the Native smoking rates are for North Carolina, but I was just curious if you were doing anything to address smoking in minority communities, if there were any culturally tailored programs or initiatives.
Sally?
Yes. Mara, you're absolutely right. Smoking rates are not equal across different populations, and smoking rates are higher among Native Americans in North Carolina and in the nation. There are tailored programs that are in communities with what have been Health and Wellness Trust Fund dollars, MSA dollars, to help communities really understand the consequences of tobacco use within their own cultural settings. We're fortunate to have that funding continue for another year. We're a little uncertain about it after a year, but we're fortunate to have that funding continue. And focusing on the cultural perspectives of tobacco use, which are different in Native American communities than they are in other communities, is an important part of that program.
How will the budget changes and budget cuts affect your operations, Ellie?
Well, we know from what we've observed in tobacco prevention and control, and especially teen tobacco prevention and control in other states, that if the budget is cut, other states that have experienced budget cuts have had their teen tobacco use rates go back up. So we hope that in North Carolina we can continue the good work that we're doing now and keep our youth smoking rates low.
And our tax rate is relatively low, the tax we impose on cigarettes.
Yes, we're 44th in the nation. Our cigarette tax rate is at 45 cents and the national average is $1.45. And what the evidence shows is that raising the price of tobacco products is one of the most effective ways you can keep kids from becoming addictive. It really breaks that cycle between experimental use and regular use. You have to have a substantial jump to make that happen. And North Carolina has seen one jump up, and we saw the youth tobacco rates decline when the tax was increased in North Carolina.
Cliff, go ahead.
Excuse me, Frank. I was just going to add to Sally's observation about the effectiveness of raising cigarette and other tobacco excise taxes. That's a critical point here, because not only does it very effectively reduce consumption, particularly among kids, and this has been demonstrated for many years, including by my colleague Ken Warner, who also happens to be profiled in Michael's book. He's a former dean of the University of Michigan School of Public Health. But the other thing that some people don't know, but this is also important, is that when you raise those taxes, you not only reduce consumption, you increase revenues. And that may sound
Well, the problem there, Cliff, I'm going to stop you right now, is then you have the state government actually with a vested interest in getting people to smoke.
Well, it's actually the reverse, because if they raise taxes, they will bring in more revenues. And since we're in no danger of reducing consumption to such a level where smoking disappears from our society in the foreseeable future, on a practical level, that really isn't a serious concern.
Now, Sally, I know the budget cuts, they do affect the program, the very program that Wade is part of, don't they?
We have funding to continue for at least 1 year, and it's a little too early to tell after that. But we're pleased to have the funding continue for a year.
Cliff Douglas, are you optimistic about the FDA's involvement in this? I mean, given the effectiveness of the tobacco lobby, do you think the FDA and having the tobacco industry, a regulated industry, is really going to make a difference?
You know, it's an essential change in what we're going to be dealing with. And no one is under any illusions that it will be easy. As Sally noted, it is complicated. But one of the changes that FDA regulation brings is an ability by the health authorities in this country to regulate the product itself, not only marketing for it and the flow of information, critical as it is, to the American people, but also to look at the toxins, the carcinogens, that is the cancer-causing chemicals in cigarettes and cigarette smoke, and figure out what ways we may have, based on the best scientific evidence, to change these products so they become less addictive and possibly less harmful to consumers. So in the absence of eliminating cigarettes and other tobacco products from our society, kind of going back to the prohibition question, what we can do, though, possibly, is change these products through FDA tools so that we cause less harm to society.
Michael Schwalbe, books like yours, other efforts and initiatives by the government and private nonprofits have had an effect on reducing smoking in this country. A lot of that has now moved overseas. Are you concerned about the increase in smoking across the globe? And what do we do about that? Or is that somebody else's problem?
Well, it's not someone else's problem. It's our problem as well. We've made great progress in North America and in Western Europe. But elsewhere in the world, tobacco companies are operating much like they did 20, 30, 40 years ago in the U.S. We have some international agreements that are now trying to be put into place to restrict and regulate in different parts of the world. But if we look at Southeast Asia, if we look at Eastern Europe, and perhaps Africa, we're seeing rates of tobacco use that are alarming. And we may be looking at a global health catastrophe in the 21st century.
Sally Herndon, we've heard talk about the tobacco industry's move overseas. Who's leading? Who, if anybody, is leading the anti-smoking effort abroad?
The Centers for Disease Control is a tremendous source of resources, not only for our nation, but for the world. And the World Health Organization is very active and becoming much, much more aware of this issue than they have in the past. So there is, as Michael says, a real problem, an opportunity to begin to face it and address it, as we have begun to do in North Carolina and in our nation, is here. It's upon us.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Michael Schwalbe, professor of sociology at North Carolina State. He is the author and photographer of Smoke Damage, a new collection of portraits and personal testimonies about the hazardous effects of tobacco use. Michael will be at Flyleaf Books on August 31st. Sally Herndon is the head of the Tobacco Prevention and Control Branch with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Division of Public Health. Wade Hampton, former smoker, laryngectomy survivor, who speaks with school children about the dangers of smoking and tobacco use. And Cliff Douglas, director of the University of Michigan Tobacco Research Network. Thank all of you for being on the program today. So great to talk with you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can hear an archived edition of a past program at stateofthings.org. You can check us out on Facebook as well. State of Things is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados, with help from Isaac Davey Aronson, Katie Barron as well. Robin Copley is our technical director, managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.